content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. And last week, our article on viruses was so depressing, maybe, that I promised something a little more uplifting for summer, and that is a story about ice cream. This is from the Smithsonian July-August combined edition, The Past is Prologue by Colin Dickey. Just desserts. As innovations go, the ice cream truck might seem merely nutty, but summer would never be the same. And there's a picture of an old-fashioned ice cream truck. Delicious, but too messy to handle, was how Ruth Burt described the new ice cream treat her father, Harry Burt, concocted in 1920. A brick of vanilla ice cream encased in chocolate. So her brother, Harry Jr., offered a suggestion. Why not give it a handle? The idea was hardly revolutionary in the world of sweets, of course. But Harry Burt himself, a confectioner based in Youngstown, Ohio, had previously developed what he called the Jolly Boy, a hard candy lollipop on a wooden stick. But ice cream on a stick was so novel that the process of making it earned Burt 2 U.S. patents, thus launching his invention, the Good Humor Bar, into an epic battle against previously developed Ice Cream Bar, a.k.a. the Eskimo Pie, a worthy rival to this day. Burt's contribution to the culture was bigger than a sliver of wood. When he became the first ice cream vendor to move from push carts to motorized trucks, giving his salesmen the freedom to roam the streets, his firm greatly expanded his business and those of his many imitators, and would change how countless Americans eat and how they experience summer. By the end of the 1920s, Good Humor settled on its signature vehicle, a gleaming white pickup truck outfitted with a refrigeration unit. Burt's mobile freezers offered a sanitary alternative to the street ice cream sold from push carts, a number of which had been the source of food poisoning and were known to peddle fare of dubious quality. An 1878 article in the Confectioner's Journal complained that street ice cream was apt to be adulterated with ingredients which sacrifice health to cheapness. To assuage consumer concerns, Good Humor had its drivers, all men until 1967, dress in crisp white uniforms, reminiscent of those worn by hospital orderlies. And, of course, the men were taught to tip their caps to the ladies. In 1932, some 14 million Good Humor bars were sold in New York and Chicago alone. And even during the Great Depression, a Good Humor driver working on commission could clear a whopping $100 a week, over $1,800 in today's money. Drivers became a welcome, personable neighborhood presence. A Good Humor truck had no door on the passenger side, so the driver could pull up to a curb, hop onto the sidewalk with a smile, and quickly distribute iced treats from the freezer unit in the back. Thanks to Burt's canny idea to equip the trucks with bells, children were guaranteed to hear them coming. Consumers gave the bells a ringing endorsement, and summer days could now be organized around the arrival of the Good Humor Man. Joan S. Lewis, a New York journalist, would recall in 1979 in an essay how new friends were made while purchasing that delicious ice cream. While sleepovers, birthday parties, and picnics were often planned right at the truck's wheels. Good Humor expanded in the post-war years, and by the 1950s, the company had some 2,000 trucks operating across the country, with a majority of their customers under 12 years old. Acquired by conglomerate Unilever in 1961, the company began to see increasing competition from Mr. Softee and other rivals. Significantly, Mr. Softee sold its products from step vans, which allow the driver to walk right back into the freezer area and dispense items directly from a side window. It didn't take a brainstorm to see that was an innovation, and Good Humor stopped ordering pickup trucks and transitioned to step vans. But it wasn't all sweetness and light in the mobile frozen goodies business. In 1975, New York City authorities charged the company with 244 counts of falsifying records to hide evidence of excessive coliform bacteria in its products. According to the indictment, 10% of Good Humor's ice cream sold between 1972 and 1975 was tainted, and products from the company's Queens production facility were not securely protected from dirt, dust, insects, and parts thereof, and from all injurious contamination. The company was fined $85,000 and forced to modernize its plants and improve quality control. By the end of the decade, Good Humor had gotten out of the mobile ice cream business altogether, turning to grocery store distribution. Yet some drivers continued to make their rounds under the Good Humor banner on their own, to the delight of generations of children. In White Plains, New York, Joseph Velarde, to cite one diehard, bought his truck from Good Humor in 1976 and kept the same route he'd had since the early 1950s. By the time he died in 2012, he had become such a beloved fixture that the town declared August 6, 2012, Good Humor Joe Day. In introducing America to the ice cream truck, its mobile refrigeration unit, Harry Burt Sr. helped launch a revolution that we are still enjoying. Indeed, our mobile food options have never been more plentiful than they are today. Food trucks now offer everything from kimchi tacos to fancy French fries to high-end Spam cuisine. In doing so, they carry on Burt's legacy of combining several American obsessions, mobility, instant gratification, convenience, to change the taste of summer. And there's a side article titled Post-Colonial Custard. The co-author of the Declaration of Independence also drafted a radical recipe by Anna Diamond. The founders shared a love of ice cream, but none was more devoted than Thomas Jefferson. In 1789, he returned from France with his chef, newly trained in making frozen desserts, and resolved to keep enjoying it. In Philadelphia in 1791, he sent to France for 50 vanilla bean pods, which he later wrote are much used in seasoning ice creams. He built an ice house at Monticello in 1802. And at Jefferson's White House that year, Senator Samuel Latham Mitchell recalled eating ice cream in warm pastry, a curious contrast, as if the ice had just been taken from the oven. Sweet Revolution. The process for making ice cream was not self-evident, so Jefferson wrote it down. Here it is, slightly condensed. 2 bottles of good cream, 6 yolks of eggs, 1/2 pound of sugar. Mix the yolks and sugar. Put the cream on a fire in a casserole, first putting in a stick of vanilla. When near boiling, take it off and pour gently into a mixture of eggs and sugar. Stir it well. Put it on the fire again, stirring it thoroughly with a spoon. When near boiling, take it off and strain it through a towel. Put it on the saboteur, that's the canister within an ice pail. Then set it in ice an hour before it is to be served. Put into the ice a handful of salt. Put salt on the coverlid of the sabretier and cover the whole with ice. Leave it still half a quarter of an hour. I guess that would be 12 and a half minutes. Turn the saboteur in the ice 10 minutes. Open it from time to time to detach the ice from the sides. Stir it well with a spatula. Put it in molds, jostling it well down on the knee. Then put the mold into the same bucket of ice. Leave it there to the moment of serving. Next up, free time. The magic of a young artist's carefree trip across the country 4 decades ago. There's a very wide-angle picture of some cars at, obviously, a drive-in movie, something I haven't seen in many years. Sunset Drive-In in San Luis Obispo, California, back in 1981. The magic of a young artist's carefree trip across the country 4 decades ago. History zeroes in on exciting and revolutionary events, disruptions. Today's disruptors like to say, but it's a fair bet that ordinary people, when we look back, are fondest of unremarkable times. A new book of photographs revisits a year within living memory that now seem enviable in that way. 1981. Simone Kepler, a French photographer, then 29 years old and fresh out of art school, spent 3 months traveling from New York City to Los Angeles in a used Gran Torino station wagon with a friend and a suitcase full of cameras. Her book, Simone Kepler, America, 1981, published by Schoediger and Spice, is a captivating album of horizons, glimpsed and encounters chanced across a vast, open, easygoing country that you might have some trouble recognizing right now. Her visit happened to take place during a lull in the socio-political action after the 1960s, the Vietnam War and Watergate, but before the chronic turmoil of the decades to come. Before AIDS, before computers, the internet and smartphones, before the Gulf War, 9/11 and the War on Terror, before the Great Recession and the violence leading to Black Lives Matter, before COVID-19. Kepler had no itinerary other than seeing Niagara Falls and the Grand Canyon and reaching the West Coast, which she recalls often pulling over, reclining the seats, and sleeping among the big rigs. The appeal of her photographs, created with technical sophistication and a variety of formats, isn't so much the subjects, which include some pretty standard road trip fare: motel pools, tourist spots, neon-lit streets, but her smiling regard for this astonishing land and its people. It's impossible not to enjoy, because she was so clearly enjoying herself. I not only discovered America, but also my own self and friendship and living independently, Kepler says from her home in Freudenfeld, Switzerland. And I discovered all the potential of photography. I wouldn't call it nostalgia, this affection for the uneventful past. It's not about pining for traditional values or the phony simplicity of limited options. On the contrary, in those less demanding times, things open up. History loosens its grip. Imagination roams. Isn't that a kind of freedom? Look at Kepler's spirited pictures and decide. And I'll try to capture or describe a few of those. One are people skating, and it's got a very slow shutter speed because they're kind of blurry, the ones that are moving. Roller skating in Manhattan in 1981. And there's a picture of somebody pushing a baby cart with Mickey Mouse ear balloon attached to it, and the cart is very simple, not like today's Rolls-Royce-looking baby carts. And by the end of her adventure, Kapler was carrying about 20 cameras, from a Hasselblad to a Brownie to a Polaroid Swinger. Thus she captured the richness and beauty of all the new discoveries on the trip. One almost looks like something from Saturday Evening Post, a boy looking out the window, and it's framed by the car door, which is scratched pretty badly. And then the other's a picture that shows a roadside sign with the name of the hotel, which isn't visible. The whole letters aren't visible. Under that is the word restaurant and vacancy, and a AAA approved sign. You don't really see those much anymore. Next story, Civil Rights by Martha S. Jones. Beyond the ballot. Winning the vote for women was a mighty struggle. Securing full liberation for women of color was no less daunting. The 19th Amendment, ratified in August 1920, paved the way for American women to vote. But the educator and activist Mary McLeod Bethune knew the work had only just begun. The amendment alone would not guarantee political power to black women. Thanks to Bethune's work that year to register and mobilize black voters in her hometown of Daytona, Florida, new black voters soon outnumbered new white voters in the city. But a reign of terror followed. That fall, the Ku Klux Klan marched on Bethune's boarding school for black girls. 2 years later, ahead of the 1922 elections, the Klan paid another threatening visit, as over 100 robed figures carrying banners emblazoned with the world's white supremacy marched on the school in retaliation against Bethune's continued efforts to get black women to the polls. Informed of the incoming night riders, Bethune took charge. "Get the students into the dormitory," she told the teachers. "Get them into bed. Do not share what is happening right now." The students safely tucked in, Bethune directed her faculty. "The KKK is marching on our campus, and they intend to burn some buildings." The faculty fanned out across the campus. Bethune stood in the center of the quadrangle and held her head high as the parade entered the campus by one entrance and promptly exited by another. The Klansmen were on campus for just a few minutes. Perhaps they knew an armed cadre of local black men had decided to lie in wait nearby, ready to fight back if the Klansmen turned violent. Perhaps they assumed the sight of a procession would be enough to keep black citizens from voting. If night riders thought they could frighten Bethune, they were wrong. That week she showed up at the Daytona polls along with over 100 other black citizens who had come out to vote. That summer, pro-Jim Crow Democratic candidates swept the state, dashing the hopes of black voters who had battled to win a modicum of political influence. Yet Bethune's unshaking devotion to equality would eventually outlast the mobs that stood in her way. Bethune's resolve was a legacy of black Americans' rise to political power during Reconstruction. Bethune was born in 1875 in South Carolina, where the state's 1868 Constitution guaranteed equal rights to black citizens, many of them formerly enslaved people. Black men joined political parties, voted, and held public office, from Richard H. Kane, who served in the state Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives, to Jonathan J. Wright, who sat on the state Supreme Court. Yet this period of tenuous equality was soon crushed, and by 1895, the white-led regime had used intimidation and violence to retake control of lawmaking in South Carolina, as it had in other southern states, and a new state constitution kept black citizens from the polls by imposing literacy tests and property qualifications. Bethune's political education began at home. Her mother and grandmother had been born enslaved, Mary, born a decade after slavery's abolition, was the 15th of 17 children and was sent to school while some of her siblings continued to work on the family farm. After completing studies at Scotia Seminary in 1895 at the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, Bethune took a teaching post in Augusta, Georgia, and dedicated herself to educating black children in spite of the barriers that Jim Crow set in the way. In 1898, Mary married Albertus Bethune, a former teacher. The following year, she gave birth to their son, Albert. By 1904, the family had moved to Daytona, Florida, where Bethune founded the Educational and Industrial Training School for Negro Girls, originally a boarding school. In 1923, it merged with the nearby Cookman Institute. And in 1941, Bethune-Cookman College was accredited as a four-year liberal arts college. The state's neglect of public education for black youngsters left a void, and Bethune-Cookman filled it by training students to assume the dual responsibilities of black womanhood and citizenship, as Mary Bethune explained in a 1920 speech. Negro women have always known struggle. This heritage is just as much to be desired by any other. Our girls should be taught to appreciate it and welcome it. Bethune had many roles at the school: teacher, administrator, fundraiser, and civil rights advocate. In 1911, she opened the region's first hospital for black citizens, McLeod Hospital, named for her parents. Aspiring nurses received hands-on training and provided care to the needy, not least during the 1918 influenza pandemic. Bethune's close friend and biographer, Francis Reynolds Keyser, K-E-Y-S-E-R, who served as a dean at her school for 12 years, later wrote, "When the hospital was filled to overflowing, cots were stretched in our large new auditorium, and everyone who was on her feet cheerfully enlisted in the service of caring for the sick. The institution spared neither pains nor money in the discharge of this important duty, and the spread of the disease was checked. Through such life-saving efforts, Bethune ensured that many white city officials and philanthropists would remain loyal to her for decades to come. By the 1920s, Bethune had discovered the limits of local politics and began to seek a national platform. In 1924, she assumed the presidency of the largest black women's political organization in the country, the National Association of Colored Women. By 1935, she was working in Washington, D.C., and the following year played a major role in organizing President Franklin Roosevelt's Federal Council on Negro Affairs, officially known as the Black Cabinet. Bethune, seeing how desperately black Americans needed their share of the benefits of Roosevelt's New Deal, solidified her influence as a counselor to the president and the only black woman in his inner circle. In 1936, FDR named her head of the office, the new Office of Minority Affairs in the National Youth Administration, making Bethune the most highly placed black woman in the administration. Black Americans had been largely excluded from political appointments since the end of Reconstruction. Bethune resurrected this chance for black Americans to hold sway at the national level and ushered a generation of black policymakers into federal service, including Crystal Byrd Fawcett, who had become the first black woman in the country to be elected to a state legislature when she joined the Pennsylvania House of Representatives in 1938. Bethune was aided by the close friendship she'd forged with First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, who saw eye to eye with Bethune on civil rights and women's issues. The two went out of their way to appear together in public in a conspicuous rejoinder to Jim Crow. During World War II, Bethune thought that the struggle of black women in the United States mirrored fights against colonialism being waged elsewhere in the Americas, Asia, and Africa, leading the National Council of Negro Women, which she'd founded in 1935. Bethune worked to ensure that the Women's Army Corps included black women. In 1945, delegates from 50 allied nations met to draft the United Nations Charter at a conference in San Francisco. Bethune lobbied Eleanor Roosevelt for a seat at the table and got one. Working with Vijay Lakshmi Pandit of India and Islanda Robeson, an unofficial observer for the Council on African Affairs, Bethune helped solidify the UN Charter's commitment to human rights without regard to race, sex, or religion. As she wrote in an open letter, "Through this conference, the Negro becomes closely allied with the darker races of the world, but more importantly, has become integrated into the structure of the peace and freedom of all peoples everywhere." For half a century, Mary McLeod Bethune led a vanguard of black American women who pointed the nation toward its best ideals. In 1974, the NCNW raised funds to install a bronze likeness of Bethune in Washington, D.C.'s Lincoln Park. The sculpture faces Abraham Lincoln, whose figure was installed there a century before. The president who issued the Emancipation Proclamation now stands directly facing a daughter of enslaved people who spent her life promoting black women's liberation. In 2021, Bethune will be enshrined in the U.S. Capitol when her likeness will replace that of Confederate General Edmund Kirby Smith to represent Florida in the National Statuary Hall. Bethune continues to galvanize black women, as Florida's Representative Val Demings explained in celebrating Bethune's selection for the Capitol. "Mary McLeod Bethune was the most powerful woman I can remember as a child. She has been an inspiration throughout my whole life." And then there's a little sidebar here. "Nobody's free until everybody's free. After suffrage, women secured further political wins. These women led the charge," by Anna Diamond. Polly Murray, a brilliant legal mind. Murray was an ardent advocate for women's and civil rights. And then there are three other women, but our time seems to have snuck up on us. We hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, if you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.